This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 18, 2002, from the Chiapas Independent Media Center in Mexico. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Ex-Enron executive, now Bush's Army Secretary, testifies before the Senate. In Idaho, a gay man is denied visitation rights with his two daughters.
He spends more quality time with his children than some married parents.
And as women in Nigeria take over more Chevron oil plants, Nigeria is locked in a dispute with Cameroon over oil for the US. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Zacharias Moussaoui, the only man now on trial for his alleged involvement in the September 11th attacks, seemed to come unglued after a federal judge refused to accept his plea change. Katie O'Keefe was in the courtroom.
Federal prosecutors arraigned Moussaoui today under new charges that include the, quote, aggravating circumstances that would make the French national eligible for the death penalty. Moussaoui's attempt to change his plea to guilty was denied by the U.S. District Judge Leon Burkima, who urged Moussaoui to enter plea negotiations with prosecutors. Moussaoui said in court today that he is an al-Qaeda member with a sworn oath of loyalty to Osama bin Laden. Although Judge Burkima previously declared Moussaoui mentally fit to defend himself, she put him on notice today that if he continues to raise issues she has already ruled on, he stands to lose that right. Moussaoui's bizarre courtroom behavior at today's hearing delayed the proceedings and forced court guards at one point to threaten physical restraint. For Free Speech Radio News in Alexandria, Virginia, this is Katie O'Keefe.
Today, Israel's defense minister said they will remain in the occupied territories as solidly as ever. The announcement comes barely 24 hours after two reportedly Palestinian suicide bombers struck in Tel Aviv. Katamesta reports on the Israeli military response to those bombings from the Gaza Strip.
Israeli defense forces bombed what they said was a factory used to build mortars, bombs, and rockets in what is called the middle area of the Gaza Strip late last night. F-16 fighter jets made four low passes over the Nusayrat refugee camp before dropping a bomb on a metal factory, leaving a wide crater some 5 meters deep. Local Palestinians say the bomb made a dull thud sound and deny accusations the factory made explosives. Local Palestinians also believe the Israelis missed their intended target, a Palestinian telecommunications building located across the street. As a result of the bombing, some 50 members of the Rajab family, who owned and worked in the factory, have no source of income in the impoverished Gaza Strip to live or to repay $20,000 in outstanding loans for the factory. In the Nusayrat refugee camp in the occupied Gaza Strip, I'm Katamester.
Turkey faces two unpleasant dilemmas, a collapsing political system, and the possible launch of a U.S.-led invasion into Iraq from their land. Nicholas Birch reports from Istanbul.
The visit of U.S. Deputy Defense Minister Paul Wolfowitz to Turkey this week could not have come at a worse time for Turkey's politicians. With their economy and government in tatters, they now have a third problem to solve: how to balance U.S. expectations that they help in a campaign against neighboring Iraq with their own public's hostility to the idea. Turks have opposed U.S. plans since the very start. Sanctions on Iraq since the Gulf War have severely affected Turkey's economy, and many fear a second war could finish it off. With early elections now set for November, any Turkish government showing the slightest enthusiasm for American plans would be perceived by the electorate as flying in the face of the country's interests. And yet, following discussions with Mr. Wolfowitz, Turkish Prime Minister Bülent Ecevit seems to have softened his position. Speaking on Turkish television last night, his request to the U.S. show all necessary caution seemed that of a man who had resigned himself to the inevitable. Nicholas Birch, Istanbul, for Free Speech Radio News.
Activist Julia Butterfly, whose record-breaking successful tree sit brought worldwide attention to the plight of old-growth redwoods in the Pacific Northwest, was put in jail in Ecuador for opposing a giant oil consortium's plans to install a pipeline across ecologically sensitive areas. Estelle Fennell with KMUD has more.
On Tuesday, Hill, along with eight local activists, was arrested outside the offices of Occidental Petroleum in Quito. Since then, insisting that the arrests were illegal, she has fought deportation in an effort to ensure the safety of the other activists and force the giant oil company to the table. But this morning, as legal proceedings were ongoing, Ecuadorian immigration police forced the passively resisting Hill to leave the country. As she was dragged by police in the pre-dawn hours through Quito Airport, she insisted she was being deported against her will only because of her solidarity with the activists. She was put on a flight to Panama and is expected to arrive in L.A. sometime this evening. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Estelle Fennell with KMUD.
The United States Postal Service rejected the idea that mail carriers should become citizen spies. Gareth Schweitzer reports from D.C.
Known as TIPS, the program encourages utility employees, truckers, ship captains, postal workers, and more to report activity they consider suspicious. Rachel King of the American Civil Liberties Union fears that the government is trading civil liberties for security and understands why the Postal Service has declined to participate in the program.
There's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't want to do this, or that any business wouldn't want to do it. For one thing, they've got people that are on company time looking for things that aren't part of their job description. And two, it can subject them to civil liability if somebody turns in false information or erroneous information.
The Postal Service did not elaborate today on why it wasn't cooperating with the Justice Department. The ACLU believes that Operation TIPS is a government attempt to slide around the Fourth Amendment, which prevents unwarranted searches and seizures. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
President Bush's Army Secretary and former Enron executive Thomas White defended himself in a congressional subcommittee today. Among other things, White's accused of helping Enron steal billions from California consumers and making insider stock sales just before Enron's collapse. Some in Congress, however, wonder if federal investigators aren't going easy on Secretary White at the behest of the White House. Joshua Chaffin reports from Capitol Hill.
Secretary of the Army Thomas White sold millions of dollars in shares in Enron just as his former company was about to collapse. In the Senate Subcommittee on Consumer Affairs today, North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan seemed convinced White also had a hand in Enron's alleged manipulation of energy markets.
You know, we've had people sitting at that table who lost their life's fortunes. We've had people who were investors in Enron that lost everything. We've had employees who lost their jobs. How much money did you make working for Enron?
I couldn't tell you. I'd have to provide it for the record.
Is it over $10 million?
Yes.
Over 20?
I don't know.
Over 30?
I'd have to add it up.
All right, we will add it up for you.
In his defense, White suggested there's no way his division of Enron, the retail side, could have illegally jacked up power prices. He says the investigation is focused on Enron's wholesale division, which at the time was the largest energy dealer in the world.
We were a very small startup business compared to the magnitude and scale of the wholesale activity.
California Democrat Barbara Boxer held her own press conference documenting 74 telephone calls White made to friends at Enron just after 9/11. Boxer suggests White was doing insider stock deals at a time when, as Secretary of the Army, he should have been working around the clock in the nation's defense. Boxer admits her evidence is all circumstantial, but she wonders why House Republicans have been quiet on the issue.
Martha Stewart. They have a whole investigation over in the House, a couple of calls from her broker or her best friend or something, and it's a, you know, Capitol Hill investigation. 74 calls here. I haven't heard peep over there.
When he took over as Army Secretary, White moved to privatize the Army's energy services, potentially an $80 million a year boon for Enron. Thomas White is still under investigation for allegedly using government aircraft to run personal errands. Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden wonders why federal investigators have been reluctant to investigate Army Secretary White.
What I'm concerned about here is whether there is a textbook case of an administration insider receiving kid glove treatment. The Securities and Exchange Commission and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission should not be looking just at Enron, but they should also be looking at the role of Mr. White as a senior official.
Lots of tough talk for the former Enron senior official in the subcommittee today, but according to the Center for Responsive Politics, in the last election cycle, members of the subcommittee together took a total of about $88,000 in campaign contributions from Enron. Only Senators Boxer and Edwards received no Enron money. President of Public Citizen Joan Claybrook says she hopes that doesn't temper the senator's treatment of Secretary White.
The only thing that ever overcomes campaign money is public outrage. And right now we have public outrage. And the consumer groups, rely on public outrage to help move an issue. And I just hope this public outrage continues long enough so that we can actually get some reforms enacted into law.
Joan Claybrook says White should be fired. White himself says what happened at Enron was a tragedy. He says if he'd known the company was going to collapse, he'd never have left to become President Bush's Secretary of the Army. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Capitol Hill.
More than a dozen liberal and Democrat-leaning interest groups across the nation are struggling to meet the demands of subpoenas recently issued by the Republican National Committee. The committee is demanding detailed financial records, internal communications, and strategic political documents from a slew of nonprofits as part of its ongoing lawsuit against the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. Groups that have been subpoenaed include Emily's List, the National Education Association, and the National Abortion Rights League. Free Speech Radio News reporter Ginger Otis has more on the story.
We work to defeat candidates that are anti-choice.
Kate Michaelman, president of the National Abortion Rights Action League, or NARAL.
The Republican National Committee and the Republican National Platform has a commitment to overturning Roe v. Wade and rolling back a woman's right to choose. So we believe that the RNC's actions are clearly politically motivated and designed to intimidate organizations like NARAL that represent the views of millions of voters.
The Republican National Committee, in conjunction with the California State Democratic Party, is demanding that several left-leaning nonprofits around the country turn over complete lists of all their donors, along with addresses, contribution amounts, and a complete accounting of what each organization does with the funds. It also wants to access internal documents detailing which donors had contact with which politicians and how nonprofits strategize to approach politicians. The RNC claims this information is necessary for its lawsuit against the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform laws. The RNC and the California State Democratic Party, along with several other groups, claim that the reform law violates their right to equal protection as guaranteed under the Fifth Amendment. RNC spokesperson Jim Dyke explains why he thinks NARAL should be required to hand over more than 800,000 pages of membership records and strategy documents.
I would think that everyone involved in the political process would strongly support greater transparency, that would strongly support people having a better understanding about who's involved in the process and who's trying to influence their vote, because that's what it comes down to. It's very clear who's involved with supporting the Republican Party. It's very clear how we use our resources. And all we're saying is campaign finance reform should support that goal.
The campaign finance reform does draw a distinction between groups such as NARAL, which work to get certain politicians elected, and official political organizations, which promote only their party's agenda. Since NARAL doesn't campaign along party lines, it will be allowed to continue fundraising and spending at the local, state, and national levels. The official parties, however, can now only spend federal funds to help elect federal candidates, a decision that is at the core of Republican rejection of campaign reform. But Jim Joseph, attorney for the D.C.-based law firm Arnold & Porter and counsel for NARAL, says the scope of the subpoenas goes far beyond Fifth Amendment-related issues. Once the confidential information of private citizens becomes public knowledge, he says, there's no telling what will be done with it. For NARAL supporters, there's a very real fear that addresses will fall into the hands of the extremist anti-choice contingent, which has a long history of violence against the pro-choice movement. The threat is real enough, says Joseph, that the IRS allows NARAL to black out donor names on tax returns to maintain anonymity.
It is a constitutional right for people like you and me and everyone else to decide which groups we want to affiliate with. And forcing us to make our affiliations and associations public, the courts have held is unconstitutional, that is something that we should be able to keep secret. And that is one argument that if we're forced to, that NARAL will make to the court in opposing this subpoena.
Many of the other organizations are also trying to cooperate with subpoena demands without giving away political strategies. Another concern is cost. Most of these nonprofits will have to hold special fundraisers if forced to comply. But several of them have also indicated they are willing to bend only so far. If necessary, they say, they'll go to court to protect membership lists and internal strategy documents. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ginger Rodas in New York.
A magistrate in an Idaho child custody case has ruled a gay man may not have visits from his two daughters unless his live-in boyfriend moves out. Father Theron McGiff has complied by moving his partner into a trailer in front of the house they bought together in Idaho Falls. But McGriff intends to fight the decision to the Supreme Court if necessary, perhaps setting legal precedents along the way. Lee Robartis has more from Idaho.
You know, I think he's awesome, and I think that he spends more quality time with his children than some married parents.
As a family friend, Fawn Goswiller spent a lot of time visiting and traveling with Theron McGriff and his two daughters during the 5 years after his 1997 divorce. Goswiller says she saw a loving family relationship.
I can certainly say most fathers, whether they're from married or divorced situations, would not schedule manicures, pedicures, massages, tea parties for their girls for their birthdays. And those are the things that he brings to the table in the fathering world.
Goswiller, who testified for Theron McGriff in the recent hearing where McGriff lost joint custody, says she got the impression the magistrate wasn't listening. McGriff's ex-wife was awarded primary custody after McGriff's sexual orientation became known, and McGriff would have lost visitation rights if his partner had not moved out. McGriff, who agreed to be interviewed for this story on the condition his voice would not be broadcast, says he'll take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. He says he's appealing on the grounds Magistrate L. Mark Riddock overstepped his bounds in putting limits on visitation and failed to weigh testimony that he had been a good father. Riddock wrote that homosexuality was not a factor in his decision, but he did say McGriff had minimized the issue of homosexuality in regard to the conservative culture and mores in which the children live. Elizabeth Brandt, an Idaho attorney on the National ACLU board, who may file a brief in the case, says community prejudices were brought up in a case before the Supreme Court years ago.
In Palmer versus Sadati, that was the main argument about race, that if the mom had this interracial relationship, the kids would be ostracized in a very conservative southern town. I think it was in northern Florida. And the Supreme said that's even if that happens, it's not a good enough reason to take race into consideration in custody.
Brandt says the court record shows no basis for concluding that visiting their father and his partner is not in the best interest of the children. Magistrate Riddock also wrote that McGriff had violated the court's orders when he failed to include his ex-wife in the discussion when he communicated the fact that he's gay to his daughters. In his interview with Free Speech Radio News, McGriff said every time his ex-wife brought up the subject of his sexual orientation, it's been derogatory comments. You faggot, you queer, you know, all those kinds of things, he says. McGriff says, in his opinion, when someone uses terms like that in front of his kids, the discussion is not going to be productive. Theron's ex-wife, Sean McGriff, and her attorney are not speaking to the media, except to say publicity is bad for the case because children are involved. Surprisingly, the executive director of the Washington State Christian Coalition says he's not likely to support the judge's ruling in the case. Rick Forcier says while the Christian Coalition is opposed to foster parenting arrangements, including same-sex couples, the judge should also be willing to extend that to include all unmarried parents.
A number of studies are showing that it is just unhealthy for the children. It puts them in a very confusing environment, for one thing. It fights, nature itself, and there are a lot of children that have grown now. It's a relatively new thing in our culture. It's been around just long enough to see some children coming out the other side of, into adulthood, out of adolescence, that do have some confusion.
The marriage question is key because critics of the ruling say it's unlikely the judge would prevent visitation if McGriff were married. Myron Kwan is with the national group Lambda Legal.
Gay people can enter into civil union in Vermont. People can enter into domestic partnership relationship in California. They can enter into reciprocal beneficiary relationship in Hawaii. So there are things that people can do in some states where there's legal recognition of our relationships. But unfortunately, since And the state of Idaho currently does not recognize same-sex relationships. In the end, it really is sexual orientation discrimination.
Idaho has a 138-year-old anti-sodomy law that provides for 5 years to life for crimes against nature. It also banned gay marriage in 1996, and the state's hate crime law does not cover sexual orientation. But there's little in state case law or legislation on gay parental rights. McGriff's next appeal is to the Idaho Supreme Court. Elizabeth Brandt of the Idaho ACLU is concerned about the conservative nature of the high court because the last two elections for the five-seat court have been unusually partisan.
Justice Eisman was elected after a controversial campaign in which he received a tremendous amount of support from conservative Christian groups within the state of Idaho, including the Idaho Christian Coalition at the time.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Moscow, Idaho.
Hundreds of unarmed women seized control of four more Chevron Texaco facilities in the Niger Delta yesterday. The occupations have been spurred by the crushing poverty in which villagers live amid the region's oil wealth. Nigeria is the world's sixth largest exporter of oil and the fifth largest supplier to the United States. And recently, Nigeria and Cameroon have been locked in a crisis over an oil-rich peninsula at the border of both countries. The crisis has also caused a conflict of interest between the United States and other Western countries with interests in oil from Nigeria's Niger Delta. Sam Olukoya reports from the Bakassi Peninsula.
The Bakassi Peninsula, located between Nigeria and Cameroon, became a subject of dispute between both countries following the discovery of oil there in the early 1980s. Tension has mounted over the years with a military build-up that has seen troops from both countries occupying each half of the peninsula. A fisherman hacks fish into bits for sale in the market. The Bakassi people are predominantly farmers and fishermen. But of late, most of their farmlands and fishing grounds have been declared military zones by either Nigerian or Cameroonian soldiers. People who strayed into these areas risk being shot dead. Etim Philip narrowly escaped death when he mistakenly went to fish in a restricted area.
There was a time I went for fishing with my friend. We didn't know that they told people not to reach to that area. So when we went there down there, I heard the sound of gun 3 times. So the next thing I saw was the bullet dropping in front of our boat, chub chub like that. So we started removing the net. So when we removed the net, we had to run back home.
The dispute over the peninsula has created a conflict of interest between Western countries like the United States, Britain, and France. Nigeria is a former British colony, while Cameroon is a former French colony. Both colonial powers still want to maintain their economic interest in their former colonies. The Bakassi Peninsula is an extension of the oil-rich Niger Delta, where the United States is turning its attention for oil, following U.S. plans to reduce dependence on Middle East oil. Oronto Douglas of the Environmental Rights Action says the Western countries are fighting an economic war in the area using their oil companies.
The contestation for the control of that region is a contest that has international, national, and global implications, because of the singular resource that is ruling the world, oil and gas. And the transnationals are the conduit pipe through which these recent manifestations are being played out.
Major oil companies like Chevron Texaco, ExxonMobil, Shell and Elf represent the interests of the three Western countries in the area. Oronto Douglas says control of the peninsula by either Nigeria or Cameroon is crucial to the Western oil companies and their countries.
So you have a situation where if it goes in favor of Britain, Shell will be properly positioned to continue to take the resources. If it goes in favor of France, Elf and Totalfina or whatever takes charge. Now, Mobil and Chevron will perhaps share in this whole booty, depending on who wins.
In March this year, Nigeria and Cameroon appeared before the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Netherlands, to present their ownership claims to the peninsula. Lawyers from both countries were joined by their counterparts from the United States, Britain, and France for the legal battle. As the court's verdict is awaited, tension has heightened with Cameroonian troops attacking Nigerian positions on the peninsula. Many inhabitants have consequently fled the peninsula. Schoolboy Ekpenyong Promise is one of them.
When I was asleep, I heard the sounds of guns shooting. But even the sounds of the gun have damaged a part of our building in the school. So I've decided to run and leave the school. So now, right now, I'm fighting for my survival.
There are fears that either country could start a war if the court's judgment does not favor them. Oronto Douglas says, in the event of war between both countries, the United States, Britain, and France will take sides. France, he says, would support its former colony, Cameroon.
I will be very confident to say that in the event of a war, France will support Cameroon. If you go to Cameroon, already there are French military personnel stationed in Cameroon, training Cameroonian gendarmes and soldiers and whatever.
He says the United States and Britain, on the other hand, will support Nigeria.
I think America's oil interest in Nigeria and, by extension, the Bakassi area is too big to be ignored. So they will be very supportive of any initiative that will protect their oil interests, even if it means war, supporting one party against the other. And we are saying the potential for them to support Nigeria is higher than that of Cameroon.
The United States is the most desperate country for oil from the Niger Delta in the wake of its plans to reduce dependence on oil from the Middle East. In the last 3 years, the United States has helped with the training of the Nigerian army and the rehabilitation of military barracks, even though the Nigerian government says this has nothing to do with oil. Many people believe it is part of an American contingency plan to keep oil flowing to the United States from the Niger Delta. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Kata Mester and Nell Geiser, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelly, Rich Kim, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.